Okay, this is Karen Brewster, and today is January 7th, 2020, and I am here with Reed and Marlene McCluskey at their lovely home in Sonora, California, and this is for the Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park Oral History Project. So thank you for letting me come visit you guys today. Appreciate it. I think we're going to start a little bit with Reed. So Reed, you were Chief Ranger from 1998 to 2006, and then Chief of Admin 2006 to 2012, correct?
Correct.
Okay, well, just before we get into that backtrack, can you tell me a little bit about your personal history? I know you grew up in Walnut Creek, California.
Grew up in Walnut Creek. I, at some point, I think on a family vacation to Yosemite, which was a habit for the family, imprinted on rangers and began answering the question, what are you going to do when you grow up? I began answering that as, yes, I'm going to be a ranger when I grew up. And I didn't know what that really meant, but it looked like it'd be cool.
Yeah.
Eventually did get a job as a park aide, a seasonal park aide at Mount Diablo State Park near our home, and had the experience, a seasonal employee experience, kind of backing up the rangers there, if you will, just doing fee collection, campground management. Going to the local community college at that point, Diablo Valley College, eventually off to Humboldt State University, and got a bachelor's in range management from Humboldt State, figuring that at one point or another I'll go to work for the government. I'd kind of been disillusioned about becoming a park ranger because it was made clear to me that California State Parks, at least, I was not ever going to work as a law enforcement ranger with my eyesight, issues I had with my eyesight. You know, they had medical standards that would have prohibited. But that wasn't the case with National Park Service at the time. Eventually, before I received my bachelor's, I saw a vacancy announcement for the National Park Service in Denver. Denver Service Center was looking for student assistants. You know, they were looking for someone to come in and work on a planning team in Denver. And I worked 6 months there initially in what at the time was called a co-op education program.
And what year did you get your bachelor's?
I finished the program 79, so yeah.
So the first job with Denver Service Center was around then?
77.
Okay.
After that first 6 month detail, went back to school, then came back to work for a service center at Redwood National Park. Detailed there to do data collection of various kinds during the summer to feed into the planning of the general management plan for the park.
Mm-hmm.
I did a number of different environmental documents of one kind or another. Yosemite National Park, its general management plan, I worked in the EIS for that, and number of much smaller projects, and eventually was detailed to Santa Monica Mountains National Recreation Area in 1981, I think. I'd been working on their general management plan prior to being detailed out there, and once I moved there and was working on site as a planning aide, if you will, I became familiar with Channel Islands National Park nearby and really became quite enamored of Channel Islands and eventually was able to engineer a career change, field change from planning to field operations to a ranger position at Channel Islands National Park in a, on a wilderness island. It's on San Miguel Island. At the time, the duty station was a wood frame tent cabin, you know, classic sort of canvas tent arrangement. And it was a 10,000 acre island, and I was most of the time the only person on the island. Somewhere along in there, I was detailed briefly to Santa Monica Mountains, back to Santa Monica mm-hmm. Mountains to help with a special event, and that's where Marlene and I met and hit it off. She and I began to staff San Miguel together. And before too long, an opening came up on Santa Barbara Island, which actually had a hard-sided Quonset hut and a little bit of running water. And so that was a step up in the scheme of things. We moved, we relocated, so we were back and forth on a 20 and 8 schedule, 20 days on duty, continuous duty, and then 8 days off on the mainland. Along in there, we started a family. So when Marlene was pregnant, got to the point where she couldn't really come back out to the island. She was working for the Park Service there at Channel Islands on the mainland headquarters for the research scientists for the park there. Applying out to other parks, I was trying to get us someplace to live together rather than apart. Applying for a hardship transfer, we were given one choice. That one option was, gee, you can go to work at Grand Canyon at Desert View, which is on East Rim Drive, out towards the Navajo Reservation, almost on the boundary of the Navajo Reservation. By that time, Arlen was, our first son was, one? When we moved to what amounted to a little employee housing area, Park Service employees there, concession employees, and I was supervising road patrol operations, campground and entrance operations, and a number of experiences, eventually our second son was born, thankfully in a hospital and not in the back of our car on the way to the hospital.
Sounds like it was nip and tuck.
I had an employee that actually did that in the back of our Volkswagen bus on the way to Tuba City. Marlene driving on that occasion. Yes, it was nice to have been born in a hospital, which was good. But eventually, as our oldest son reached school age, we needed to move on from there. We couldn't stay there. So we had five years there, and eventually moved to Albuquerque and to a brand new park, Petroglyph National Monument. We were among the very first staff assigned to the park. City of Albuquerque had an open space program, an open space division that we were to partner up with. They had some lands. The National Park Service would begin a land acquisition program there, and that was a big part of my job. It was to put together the first ranger division, the first resources division, you know, the staffing, buy land, set up offices. And it was a difficult time for me as the challenges working for a superintendent. I won't go into the details there, but it's a very challenging time. And after 7 years, we were ready to move on from there. I had been applying to a variety of parks without success, and took a personal vacation trip. I think we took a month off. Wasn't that right?
Maybe.
It was a month or 6 weeks. I don't know. Took a month off, I thought. A personal trip took us to Alaska. And what we did was to did a little bit of time in Vancouver Island, and then got on the Canadian ferry, and then transferred to the Alaska Marine Highway ferry, setting up our tent on the after deck,
right.
And basically stopping at various stops along the way. The one place we did not get to on that trip was Skagway. We did get to Yakutat. We actually flew to Yakutat because one of the places that I applied was there was an opening at Glacier Bay,
mm-hmm.
Park. And after the four of us visited Yakutat, I think we agreed that that probably was not going to work for us. That was going to be too difficult. But I don't know how much longer. It must have been 6 months after that or more.
It was 2 years.
Was it?
Yeah.
After that?
Mm-hmm.
Seriously?
Yeah, because we went in the summer, and remember, another summer goes by, and then the next spring was when we moved to Skagway, mid-April.
Wow. Yeah.
And that would have been April of 1998?
98.
Yes. April 13th.
She knows exactly. Before we get into all this,
yeah.
I'm going to stop mm-hmm. and ask Marlene if she would give a little bit of her personal background and how you ended
to
up.
Oh, catch up, yeah.
Yeah, catch us up with how you got into, working at Santa Monica. And
yeah.
Get your background.
Well, I was born in the L.A. area and Long Beach. And after I graduated from UCLA, I applied for a lot of government jobs. And the one that called was Yellowstone, and they had a last-minute person drop out, so he said, well, can you be here in a week? So I had to pack up my apartment, quit my job, and drive to Yellowstone in a few days. And I didn't drive, that's right, my Volkswagen blew up, so I had to take a bus. And I remember getting to West Yellowstone, and I thought it was kind of like summer camp, because I called my supervisor and I said, I'm here! And send somebody to get me! So the park geologist, Roderick Hutchinson, came and got me and deposited me at Grant Village. And so it was a few days before the training started. And what I realized when I got there was like, oh, I had an apartment, but I had no food, and there was no stores. And so for several days there, I just sort of sat there very hungry until they finally came and got me, for the training. And so that was my first summer as a park ranger, and did a lot of training back then. And so
what was your education and what was your degree?
Political science.
Okay.
Yes.
So very related.
But actually, I don't know why I majored in political science, other than the fact that I could get the degree faster, because all my classes were really in geology and marine biology and stuff, so really had more of an interest in natural history. So then I worked at Yellowstone for 3 summers and 2 winters, went to Glacier for a summer, then went to Indiana Dunes from there, and then back to Golden Gate, worked at Alcatraz, then for Park Police, and then they called me from Santa Monica Mountains. So I went down, in between there I had gone to the Law Enforcement Academy in Santa Rosa, and so then I worked a couple of years, it seemed like, at Santa Monica Mountains doing road patrol, which was a lot of fun, and like Reed said, that's where I met him during the Renaissance Fair there. And then my season ended up closing, and then I did work briefly for a permanent job for Channel Islands for the science division. And in between there, I had Arlen, and then
moved to Grand Canyon, and like we said, then I had John and Flagstaff, and then we were there for a while, but it wasn't going to work after the school because the school was in the village, and that was 25 miles on a snowy road and all that involves. And so we then moved to Albuquerque, and the kids were able to go to school. Actually, in between there, I wanted Arlen to do a little bit of school, so we moved to Vancouver, Washington, where my parents were. So I took the boys and got them in school there, and I worked at Fort Vancouver National Historical Site, and so it was kind of interesting. And then he got the call that we were offered the job at Boston, which we turned down after thinking we got the job offer at Albuquerque. So then we were there in Albuquerque for a number of years, and there's a lot of crime in Albuquerque. We were touched by that a couple of times, and it was kind of intense. And so we decided that we really wanted to move out of there right away. And so we took the first job that came open in Alaska. And I remember Clay Alderson called, and Reed was out at El Malpais for some reason. And so Clay said, "Well, you guys want to, you know, come up here to Skagway?" And I said, "Yes, yes, we do." So I accepted the job for us. And so that was nice. Clay was a very nice person. We really enjoyed working for him.
Now, how did you get interested in working in the parks if that was not your original background?
Oddly, Reed and I both had sort of a similar childhood growing up. Our parents would take us to, they both had Volkswagens. We both went to the campground there in the Valley of Yosemite, and we would float on our little air mattresses on the Merced River. Oddly, we didn't know each other, but that's how our paths must have crossed, but we didn't ever meet. And we were always, I think, both impressed by the park, you know, and park rangers, you know, going to the programs and stuff. But I never really pictured myself as a park ranger, because in those days there weren't any women park rangers. And in fact, in a couple of the parks that I worked law enforcement, I was the first woman who ever did law enforcement in Glacier, and one of the first ones in Indiana Dunes. So, but yeah, it was just kind of a natural progression that, you know, they called me in Yellowstone. I worked parks and kind of got into that whole track.
Mm-hmm. What did you do at Yellowstone?
I was an interpretive ranger there for five seasons.
Okay.
Two winters and three summers. And then when I went to Glacier, I was law enforcement. Indiana Dunes, I was law enforcement. Santa Monica Mountains, I was law enforcement. And at Alcatraz, obviously, I was an interpreter. So, and then at Channel Islands, I worked as for the science division. And then when we moved to Alaska, to Klondike, I worked as a kind of a split position between the natural resources and interpretive, and I did all the bear brochures, the bear posters, the bear management plan, a lot of bear awareness stuff, and I think they're still passing out the same brochure that I put together then. So that was kind of fun. And then I worked a season as
NAMHA.
Yeah.
The Natural History Association.
Yeah, the Natural History Association. And that was fun. I enjoyed that. I was a year-round sort of job because I was like ordering books and things and then managing the little bookstore in the summer. So I did that a couple of those seasons. And in between, I worked also for cultural resources, cataloging with Deb Betcher and Deb Sanders.
But so being one of the only women in law enforcement, that was also at the academy. Were you one of the few women there?
When I went there, it was one of the first classes that they had there. That was like around 1980. No, 70. 1978, I think. So one of the first classes at Santa Rosa, and we stayed there at Los Guilicos, which was had been a California Department of Youth Authority institution for girls. And so they hadn't really done anything to the classroom, to the classrooms, the cells. And so you had to be sure you didn't lock yourself in. And they had a little toilet there in the room, and it was kind of weird. And there's like a lot of graffiti on the wall, Jane loves Mary and stuff like that.
You got to experience both sides of law enforcement, what it would have been like to be in jail and while you were learning.
There's a way of putting it, yeah. So I actually did very well at law enforcement. I was the best female shooter and the fastest female driver and got awards. That was a lot of fun driving those cars just to death. But that was because it was one of the first season, they hadn't actually gotten the institutionalized driving thing. They just brought cars and you just drove them around until they blew up, you know. And so I ended up skidding out and landing on top of a tree once and kind of caught the tree on fire. And then they dragged the car off. So that was that kind of stuff.
But so was your whole class women then?
No, it was a mixed class.
Mixed class.
Yeah. And so there's the number of the women that I went to school ended up being regional directors or superintendents and stuff like that. They went on, they stayed in the Park Service, and they did not have kids, so they were able to devote their entire life to the Park Service. So
isn't the what's the there's an acronym for the Park Service Law Enforcement?
FLETC.
This was
Santa Rosa. So that was it was a seasonal law enforcement, and it wasn't as long as FLETC at the time. I think at the time FLETC was like 3 months or something, and this was more like 6 weeks, something like that, 6 or 8 weeks.
FLETC was 9 weeks.
Yeah, so it was about half, as I recall. But anyway, long story.
So FLETC stands for...
Federal Law Enforcement Training Center.
That's what I thought.
It was located in Glencoe, Georgia.
And the Santa Rosa thing is run by the Santa Rosa City College. And so they just started a program. And afterwards, several other places around the country started little law enforcement academies. So.
Yeah, I thought FLETC was the only place. I didn't realize there were other ones.
The FLETC was for permanent employees, and so it was paid for by the government. Her academy came out of her pocket.
Okay.
Right. Everybody had to pay for their own. Now, oddly, I was working at the time, sort of for a short time, for the city of Long Beach, California. And I got called, and they said, okay, there's an opening at Santa Rosa for you to go to law enforcement. Well, I went to my boss and I said, oh, look, I'm sorry, I really want to do this. And he said, oh, is it training? And I said, well, yeah. He goes, tell you what, we'll continue to pay your salary. We will pay for the training and we'll send you there and give you an allowance and everything. And I was like, really?
Wow.
Yeah. And I said, okay. So I did that. And so I was the only person there at Santa Rosa, probably in the history, that ever got paid and got everything paid for them. And then after that, I got a couple of offers from jobs, and I had to tell my boss back in Long Beach, I was like, oh, I'm sorry, I'm not coming back. But they understood.
But so, Reed, you went to FLETC.
I did.
Right? When did you go?
In 1983.
Because I met you in 82, and 82. You just gotten back.
That's right. I just
in the spring, so you went 82. Over the winter 82. Of 81, yeah. 82.
I arrived there in like January, January, February.
Because you said you'd been in planning, so how did you transition from being in the planning into being law enforcement?
I'd had experience, you know, for California State Parks as a seasonal, so I had some operational experience. I convinced my supervisor, Denver Service Center supervisor, who had become fast friends with the superintendent at Channel Islands, that I would be a worthy candidate to transition, to move into the field that I really wanted to work in. but on the condition that I stayed long enough to finish the general management plan for Santa Monica Mountains, which is what we did. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize how close my boss had come to the superintendent at Channel Islands until later they announced they were getting married.
Oh.
So, it was a case of, you know, who you know, mm-hmm. and at the right time. Part of what I did to try and tip the scales in my favor was on hearing that the island ranger position at San Miguel had come open. I volunteered to go out and staff the island for a 10-day tour, and another park employee, a friend of mine, the two of us basically were as volunteers.
Right.
We were taken out by boat. San Miguel, dropped on the beach at dark, basically at the end of the day, given directions down the beach and up a canyon where we would probably find, if it hadn't been burned down by someone, they said, you'd probably find a cabin there, and you know, that's where you can stay for the next 10 days. Here's a radio, you know, and call in every morning. And what we did was to meet anyone coming ashore. At the time, the Navy owned the island, still does own the island, and required that all visitors ashore be escorted. And so I did that for 10 days. I think it was about that amount of time. And just fell in love with the place and the job. But convinced people that I could actually take care of myself out there. Mm-hmm. So that was part of it.
Well, I didn't know if for FLETC, do you have to go there first before you can apply and get a job as a ranger?
At the time, it was not a prerequisite.
Okay.
I had a bachelor's. That was a prerequisite. So you had to have, you know, a bachelor's at least to apply. So they could bring me on to the position, but the park chief ranger at the time had resisted hiring me over his boss's objections. You know, I was hired. Or his objections were overridden by his boss, the superintendent, who said, no, it'll be great. But then they started putting me through a battery of different training courses.
Okay.
And one of them was to be sent to FLETC. At the time, I had a full beard, which I didn't shave off. I couldn't believe I was one of three or four of us actually in the class that actually had beards in this law enforcement class. And had some challenging experiences there. But on the heels of that came scuba training, wildland firefighter training, boat operations. So a pretty intensive training course. It felt like, you know, kind of about 4 months, 5 months of intensive basic training, if you will. But by that time, I'd worked on the island by myself for months. During that intensive training period is when I was detailed over to the nearby park, Santa Monica Mountains,
right.
to work as a patrol ranger in the parking lot, us as the parking rangers. Otherwise, I don't know if we would have had occasion to meet one another. FLETC, I think for most law enforcement rangers, even today, are hired and then sent to FLETC.
Okay.
It's now a much longer, much more involved process. As you may have heard from Tim Stidell, the challenges of getting somebody that's suitable for your park's needs, getting them then trained in law enforcement, and then to complete their field training program successfully, and then to come back and work at your park, mm-hmm. has become extremely difficult.
Well, that's why I asked which came first, the training or, you know, mm-hmm. Did you have to already have law enforcement background to get a job as a ranger?
I think for most individuals who today, and maybe even back then, most individuals did have seasonal training, seasonal law enforcement experience, then would be hired on permanently, and then be sent to FLETC.
Okay.
And so that was probably the rule, rather than, and right. I was the exception.
Right.
I was never sent to Ranger Skills. That would be something that typically a new permanent employee would be sent to, a new permanent ranger would be sent to. But by the time that opportunity arose, I'd been working for the National Park Service, state parks and national parks, long enough, and the breadth of training I'd already received, they said, well, it really doesn't, you don't need to go to Ranger Skills. Mm-hmm. I just said, forget it.
So when you got to Skagway in 1998, I'm getting my dates wrong. What did you encounter with the job?
What I encountered was a superintendent who seemed to thoroughly enjoy the town, his job, seemed to be a very affable person, and he had very recently made changes in the park organization that were reflected in the position description that I, the vacancy announcement they applied for, which was Chief of Visitor Protection and Resources Management. It, up to that point, had it also been a position that supervised interpretation. And because they did not have a Chief of Administration at that time, de facto, that chief ranger position had essentially been an assistant superintendent, in mm-hmm. practice. And so when I arrived, that's the way people treated me in the park. That's what, it was a great deal of deference among the rest of the staff, because I was basically, the executive officer for the park. The permanent interpreter who was to become the new chief of interpretation was already there, only his position description had not been changed, and nothing had happened. And he showed up in my office basically saying, well, when are you going to do that? He was answering to me,
right.
Even though on paper he wasn't my charge. And so one of my first duties was to rewrite his position description, get it classified, and basically set up his new division for him.
Right. So he was supposed to be head of the interpretation division and not report to you.
Right.
But that
only he was kind of digging his heels in, because it was like, well, that hasn't happened and should happen, and you need to make it happen. And I was kind of confused by that. Mm-hmm. And that individual is David Esslinger. He had one permanent employee working for him, Paul Lofgren. And Paul seemed to be more or less content doing what he was doing, which was, mainly summer activities, and then kind of handling what things came up in the winter when he wasn't on furlough. So he was a subject to furlough employee. And Paul, I think, had been there longer than David, I want to say.
Longer? My impression was, because my office was right next to theirs.
Right.
Paul was on one side, yeah. And David was on the other. Was that, now I don't remember why I knew this, but David was one of these people that felt like he didn't want anybody doing something that would be more than he could do, so he told Paul to do nothing. So Paul was
cooler.
Yeah, told to sit there and do nothing. But David didn't really do much either, from what I can see. I had to get his approval for every stupid book that I ordered.
Oh, because he was interpretation.
Right. Yeah, and so I would spend all this time, you know, getting books that I thought would be really good. And then I would say, okay, can we sell this? Can we sell this? Can we sell this? And then he would take months to decide on these books. The deadlines would go by before I could order them until they'd be there. You know, and he's like, oh, I'm going to get to that. And in the meantime, he would be surfing for jokes. And he would print off a joke or a stupid story. Then he would cut the paper so that you couldn't see, you know, on the top which computer it came from him. And then he would pass these around the office. That was his... The sum total of what I
did. So at that point, there wasn't a very, robust interpretation and exhibits program?
No. He did nothing.
What exhibits were there were already there when he arrived. I mean, those had been done up, you know, when the buildings were done.
And did your guys' offices were already in the old depot?
Yes.
That had already been restored and,
yes,
and that visitor center area down there.
So my office was across the hall from the superintendent's. So a view out over the harbor, you know, the trains coming in and all that. I think that first spring, I kind of got a little pissed because nobody had thought to mention to me that when the locomotive arrived at the depot there, they were also arriving at a crossing. And so they would just lay on the horn right there. And that, I think I had my window open at the time. I about jumped out of my chair. You know, it was... yeah, it was like the season arriving full on was pretty amazing. But, the organization of the park was undergoing change. And so I was to affect some of that. But the way that Clay had advertised my position set up a dilemma for me that... cascaded through time and created some real significant issues for me. And the problem was that the position had been advertised not as an approved secondary law enforcement position explicitly. And that's part of why I had applied to it. On arrival, what I found was, oh no, Clay fully expected that this was a law enforcement position and I would remain as a commissioned law enforcement supervisor. And yet he hadn't actually written it up that way. And so it actually, I mean, we had to go back and redo some things, but the very fact that it didn't start out that way, broke the continuity of law enforcement creditable service for retirement purposes. So, and that's why, that's in large measure why I think I got the job, was that whatever other competition I might have had Clay actually advertise that correctly, there might have been some much more significant competition.
Because if there were...
Well, I think everybody else who was super concerned about their law enforcement retirement knew, okay, this would jeopardize that.
Because it wasn't advertised in that
exactly
way, even though you ended up doing that work.
Right. And what's more, when I arrived, I also found that for reasons that surpass understanding, Clay Alderson still had a law enforcement commission and badge.
Oh, as superintendent, that's not normal?
That's not normal. And in fact, it was not to continue because he had not kept up with law enforcement refresher training and law enforcement firearms qualifications and so on. And so among my first responsibilities, in contacting the regional law enforcement specialist, he said, you know, you need to retrieve those and his weapon.
Yeah.
Well, things were really vague in the Park Service between like 1976 1990, yeah. In there, it was like, when I started with the Park Service, there was no armed rangers. You kept your gun, if you had one, rolled in a towel, like a bath towel, under the seat of your patrol car.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember when I had first gotten my commission, a seasonal law enforcement commission in Yellowstone, even though I was working as an interpreter, the law enforcement rangers knew that I had a commission. And oddly, I mean, it was just kind of loosey-goosey. And one time they had a situation where they were chasing somebody, and they asked me to get into the car, and could I get their gun out of the briefcase? They had one in the briefcase, and then as we're driving down the highway, he was trying to put the holster on his belt and put the gun in the holster and try not to shoot him. And
doing this for him. Yeah.
You were doing this for him.
Yeah, and only because I had a commission and I was trained, but somewhat. Anyway, and so, yeah, we ended up getting, pulling the guy out of the car or something. I don't remember, it was a long time ago, but it was like 40 years ago. But but the progression from that point on, how they kept changing the role of the law enforcement officer to the point in you know, dividing out the interpreters and the law enforcement rangers to the point where they were in competition, and then mm-hmm. yeah, it really changed the whole feeling of the Park mm-hmm. Service.
Yeah, that's a good point, that there's been a progression, that
mm-hmm.
you didn't always, being a ranger didn't always mean carrying a gun and being law enforcement.
And,
yeah.
and up until that point, by and large, individuals were hired for ranger duty because they either were going to be a ranger naturalist, they had some sort of education experience in a professional field,
mm-hmm.
and they brought that to work with them. And in some cases, you had other skill sets, but they were hiring people that really wanted to work in parks and park operations, and then training them as a, like a collateral duty.
Right.
Training them in law enforcement.
Right. But so.
And what changed was that in 94, professionalization of the workforce, that whole initiative created this division between the two flavors, park rangers mm-hmm. interpretation, park rangers law enforcement. And that was being driven by OPM's approach to law enforcement rangers, and there were quite a number of individuals petitioning OPM to recognize law enforcement duties as qualifying for enhanced annuity retirement. So it's an accelerated retirement program because there's a maximum age of 57. You have to retire at age 56. So you've got to earn your retirement faster. Well, that schism essentially set the stage for where it's gone, which is individuals being hired as law enforcement rangers today are coming out of, like, you know, military experience, military police, or administration of justice programs. They have gone into law enforcement, and then later in the game have said, gee, wouldn't it be great to work law enforcement in a park?
Right. And there's a different...
Very different mindset.
Right. What is OPM?
Oh, the Office of Personnel Management.
Okay. Yeah, that what you said about the mandatory retirement age and making it there sooner, that's like regular police officer... Firefighters, they have a shorter time.
Law enforcement and firefighters, right.
Yeah.
But you can't, this is part of the problem that the Park Service and the Park Rangers ran into, was that the justification for early retirement, for an age limitation, is the need for a so-called young and vigorous workforce.
Right.
And that was driven by the nature of the work itself. So law enforcement work, inherent in nature, same with firefighting, really, you could apply the same to search and rescue. You know, these are all very stressful.
Trail rangers.
Trail rangers, you know, mm-hmm. backcountry patrol, right. all of those. Any one of those should qualify. In combination, OPM does not recognize that at all. So mm-hmm. They basically were trying to take individuals in the park ranger field and they were applying standards for other specialty fields, police, fire, and so mm-hmm. on, scuba, you know, any one of those, they would say, if you were doing 51% of any one of those things, then you would qualify. Well, what that did was that if you worked in a park, say it like El Malpais out there and mm-hmm. you know, out in the sticks, where they occasionally needed somebody to do law enforcement, it was all or nothing. You right. either had to do, your job had to be declared as 51% or more law enforcement, or not at all, period, right. nothing. And superintendents and all the rangers that were working out there said, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, you bet, 51, in fact, it's probably 52%. You know, I spend all sorts of time apprehending bad dudes. Okay, this is like, only for most parks, that's not actually the right. case. You're okay. actually doing a lot of other things.
Right, which is why, to get us back on track,
yes.
thank mm-hmm. you for that explanation, mm-hmm. that's helpful, that a superintendent at Klondike Gold Rush National Park's job probably is not doing law enforcement if you have a chief ranger and trail rangers who are commissioned.
Yes. When I arrived, though, the only other commissioned employee on the staff was Tim Steidel, was working as a protection ranger. The protection ranger is the one only. And so it was just the two of us as okay. commissioned employees there. Clay had to relinquish his commission. So that was accomplished. But I set about immediately trying to correct the oversight in his vacancy announcement and was never successful at doing that. And so while the position eventually was designated as a law enforcement supervisor position, there was a discontinuity in my history and there was no hope of my ever qualifying. About the same time at the national level, the same time as I arrived there at Klondike, at the national level, medical standards for law enforcement positions were being developed and imposed for the first time ever. And what that translated into was that eventually I started having to have annual, at my age at that point, annual full physicals, medical exams, vision, hearing, you know, the works. Mm-hmm. That resulted in, with the new medical standards that had not been in place before, they said, well, you don't meet the medical standards, and so you really, you're a hazard to yourself and everybody around you, and you can't be commissioned. And so I would petition saying, well, I've done this job for the last 25 years, and I'm now working in an office position, mm-hmm. essentially. Yes, it's a commission, you know, it's a secondary supervisory law enforcement position, but the most of my time is spent doing other things and working in an office. I was successful in making those arguments, but I had to do that twice, literally 2 years running. So it became an annual affair. I'd go through the annual physical. They would say, oh, you don't qualify. I'd say, well, yes, but I have this history and this is the nature of the work. Yeah. Oh, they'd say, and I would have to actually testify before a review board in order to obtain. And each time that happened, Tim was required to hold my commission and my firearm. So I would dutifully turn those over to him, my subordinate, and say, don't let those go anywhere.
Right.
And yeah, this just became, and no pun intended, but a run and gun battle with the forcible transition of an extant workforce being driven into medical standards that were never, you know, intended for someone of my circumstance. So that's what set the stage for the change in assigned duties and my position there at the park. I wasn't ready to take a disability retirement, you know, for a number of reasons. I thought this is really not going to work. The other changes that had been the park organization had been undergoing were having effects on everyone in the park as well. When Clay Alderson was superintendent, I've already described kind of how that worked.
Mm-hmm.
There came a time when one of the primary controversies surrounding the park at that point, and it was a definite bone of contention between the Park Service and the city. So City of Skagway, the mayor was John Milkey, who in his day job was the chief engineer for White Pass and Yukon Route Railroad. And there was bad blood between the railroad and the park. You probably know enough about the origin of that. I don't know that I should go into too much of it, but what I'll say is that there had been a legal case brought by the United States against White Pass and Yukon Route Railroad following the discovery that the railroad had been illegally quarrying material from the Tongass National Forest adjacent to the rail line. And it came to light because in the process of doing that illegal quarrying with heavy equipment off the side of the tracks, they had accidentally punched a hole in a fuel pipeline. Hmm. World War II era fuel pipeline that paralleled the tracks on the surface of the ground. The pipeline had not been in use in many years. Nobody thought there was anything in it. They punched a hole in it. Guess what? There's like thousands of gallons of like product in the line that had never been pigged
out.
They
hadn't drained it all out.
They hadn't drained it out. And so it spilled down into the Skagway River and on into town enough to where there were phone calls made from townsfolk to Alaska,
Department of Environmental Conservation.
Right, DEC.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually it was discovered that it had originated on federal lands and that this quarrying was going on. So the railroad, all predating my time mm-hmm. at Klondike, but all of this had taken place. So there were court cases eventually. It's like the railroad right-of-way maintenance. I don't know what his title, what was Ed's title? It would have been maintenance of way.
Something like that.
Foreman was the one that took the fall for the railroad. So he did jail time. The president of the railroad resigned, a guy named Paul Taylor. So Paul resigned, Ed does jail time, you know, it's like all this, and the suspicion among everybody at the railroad was that it had really been the Parkies that had dropped the dime on him.
Somehow and Claudia got the brunt of the, I never quite understood why, but everyone
was convinced.
Claudia Alderson?
Yeah.
Rector Alderson?
Yeah.
Right. And because you have that as backdrop, Clay leaves his wife, who's extremely popular in town, takes up with Claudia, who's then associated with somehow this deal. You know, Clay became this lightning rod for, you know, and, you know, he was a plain-spoken guy. And eventually, the deputy regional director, Paul Anderson, arrived from Anchorage, evening meeting with Clay, and told him, you know, we got a great job waiting for you in Fairbanks. You're going to love it. The FAPLIC. Fairbanks.
Alaska
Public Land Information Center.
Okay. Yep. So when we arrived there, it was kind of like just right after the, you know, this huge fight in town. Half the people in town were, you know, working for the park or
for the railroad.
I mean, and even within the people that were working for the railroad, you know, they had to, certain people were called to testify on that. And if they told the truth and said what they knew, then they were ostracized by the other White Pass people who all lied and said they didn't know what was going on. And so, and those animosities held for decades.
Oh,
really?
Yeah.
Up until fairly recently, when a lot of the old folks have actually moved or passed away. And so when we arrived, I remember this one instance, the boys, the first day of school, you know, they were in, fifth and seventh grades,
yeah.
And, you know, right at the end of the school year, mm-hmm. April. And apparently there were boys in there that, you know, their dads worked for the railroad, and so they, after school, the boys came out on the grass, and these other boys said, "My dad works for the railroad, and he hates the Park Service. Who does your dad work for?" And they punched, and they had gotten into a punching fight right there in front of the school, and that. You know, like in most schools now, that's not considered okay.
Right.
But there, people just like, you know, threw their hands up because it was like, well, whatever, you know, it was Park Service and White Pass. And yet that mellowed over the years, you know, once the boys had gone to the school for a while, it was kind of, and now I think it's kind of turned the whole other way, you know, it's kind of like all of that's forgotten now.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
it's for most, yeah, not all of them, but yeah.
But you know, you certainly hear about when the park first came in, there was that animosity against the Park Service from White Pass. But then White Pass closed, and oh, look, there are jobs available.
Right.
So I kind of thought some of that had mellowed. So I'm surprised that still in 1998 there was still that conflict.
It had suffered the relationship had suffered a setback, tremendous setback, with this case involving, it was even more complicated because the material that was being illegally quarried was being loaded on hopper cars and transported down to the dock,
mm-hmm.
and then stockpiled in the dock and being sold. Okay, so being moved on. Well, eventually there was so much material stockpiled in the dock that, oh, that was when, and this is still contested, the dock collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
Huge tidal wave across the harbor washes people into the drink, and there's fatalities.
Oh.
Okay, big deal. Okay. Well, the contention the railroad had was that, oh, there was an underwater landslide, and it had nothing to do with the hundreds of tons of rock and gravel mm-hmm. that were stockpiled on the dock.
That were stolen from the...
Stolen from the, you know...
Right. Then the federal land it was being quarried from was Tongass National Forest.
Right.
It wasn't Park Service.
Right.
So how was it that the Park Service was even involved in any of this?
The Forest Service doesn't have an office or presence in the town, and Park Service does. And so the Park Service environmental specialists were drawn in at times. And in fact, I've forgotten her name, that first fall in 98, must have been in October, I got a phone call from this woman who, environmental specialist, was on her way down from Anchorage. Her job was to arrive in Skagway, board Casey Carr, you know, one of these motor cars,
mm-hmm.
go up that line, and be the observer, the official observer for the agency, as the railroad, under basically court order, was cutting up that old military fuel line, World War II era fuel line that was along the tracks. So they were supposed to cut it up into sections, load it onto flat cars, and then haul it out. So it was all going to be remediated. Her job was to make sure that there wasn't additional product spill.
Right.
She got weathered in Juneau. So she called me at home to say, I can't make it there. I'm not going to get into town. Can you go in my place? And I said, okay, what am I supposed to do? She said, you just have to show up to
being
the...
like, what?
Sure. Bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. Yeah. I said, where? She said, you need to be at the railroad shop up the north end of town, 6 o'clock tomorrow morning, and meet the crew, basically just accompany them. They're going to go up the tracks, up to a number of miles, and just observe, just stand by and watch. I said, okay, I can do that. Well, my entire career with the Park Service, you went somewhere in official duty, you went in uniform, which I did, went up to the railroad shops, and it was, you know, in October, so it was certainly plenty dark. Couldn't find anybody. Tried doors on the shop, and eventually found an open door. Went on in, wandered around the interior of the train shop, found the offices, and lights on, but nobody there. Wandered around outside, and finally bumped into this individual, the maintenance of way foreman, who was already basically going to be serving time while he was back and forth. Ran into him. I'd never met him before, didn't know him from Adam, and he was not pleased to see me there, needless to say, but he didn't, he bit his tongue, and he was even kind enough, let's say, to not only give me a hard hat for the day, but also a quilted liner for the hard hat, because we were going, you know, up high to, enough, right. It was going to be plenty cold. And so the next couple of 3 days, that was what I did. And later, somebody told me, they said, you were in uniform in the dark in the train shop, and you got out alive? they said, I expected I would have been buried under a, you know, a pile of bolts. You know, that was just hard, really hard feelings.
Yeah.
I guess I brushed it off. It wasn't my fight. Mm-hmm. And I'd been, had no part in it. And what I saw during the operation there was just as what people expected. There were no surprises. But that was just, you know, part of what was going on at the time.
So that lingering animosity then carried over with the city in the park?
Oh, yeah. Because, and the reason I made the connection was that, again, the chief engineer for the railroad was mayor.
Right.
And he...
And half of the people on the council worked for the White Pass.
Right. Mm-hmm. The city council dominated by railroad employees. And so I had the same reaction from others saying, you went to a city council meeting in uniform? Oh my God, what did they do? I said, nothing, you know. But John Mielke settled on in my view, my opinion was that he decided that a great opportunity to stick it to the Park Service, to create an issue where, you know, I didn't personally think there was one, was the intersection of 5th and Spring Streets.
The Morehouse property.
Morehouse property. The configuration of the Moore property, of course, you'll know, is the result of earlier court battles fought by Captain Moore. And, you know, the property that he ended up with doesn't configure to the street grid for town.
Well, that's because when he was fighting for that, that street grid was not quite all there, right?
Well, when he settled his property and then some prior to the gold rush, years prior to the gold rush. And so when Frank Reed laid out the town, it was with a, we're going this way and that way, and what's that cabin doing there?
Right.
You know, I mean, yeah, they just run roughshod over Moore. Took him years in court to win his cases, which he did, you know, and he got quite a bit out of it. But the part of the history, the story of the history of Skagway is told in that property.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way Clay felt, was that this is should be inviolate.
Right.
Federal land. It's actually owned by the Park Service. And here's the... And what the mayor wanted to see was a full widening of the street at that turn, at that corner, rather than it being pinched the way it was at that time. The contention that the mayor made at the time was that it's just not safe. You got all these tour bands, you got, you know, whatever, people going through in there. It's just, and so Clay set his jaw, and so did the mayor. And as far as the regional office was concerned, regional director, you know, they didn't like getting phone calls from Don Young's office, you know, saying, would you fix this, iron it out? And that's what happened, was that the mayor went to the delegation. The delegation leaned on the region. The region said, well, Clay, if you're not willing to, if you can't figure out how to, you know, make this work, then we need to have somebody else in here. And so he was invited to, his next paycheck was going to be at, at the Fatblick. So it was very disappointing for Clay and for me personally, because I got along quite well with him. I liked him.
Mm-hmm. And what was your feelings about that property and the street alignment?
I felt that this was a political fight that had been picked by the city, and perhaps it's really more than that. It's the city and the railroad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was like let's give the Park Service a black eye here somehow. There was eventually a deal cut, as you're probably aware, that resulted in a change in the fence line. The city was supposed to place a prominent corner marker on the property there. They put in some small brass marker, but it's not at all what it was supposed to have been. The city also paid for a number of interpretive wayside panels to be produced. It seemed to me there was something else. So, you know, it was a compromise deal that was struck, but not by Clay, by the acting who was assigned in after him.
It wasn't done by Bruce Noble, Clay's successor?
Bruce didn't arrive until about a year after Clay left, as I recall.
So there was somebody acting in between.
Yes. I'm going to struggle for her name, but I probably won't get that.
Wasn't Linda Cook?
Might have been.
No.
Actually, it might have been Linda Cook. I'm trying to remember if she was the one, or, you know, yeah, I'm gonna scramble those. I need to see a timeline.
I don't want to misspeak. I'm sure it's in the admin history.
Right. Well, it's not going to be in this one.
Oh, no, because it's before that.
So
it got settled by whoever was acting.
Right.
Okay.
Who came after. I felt bad for Clay, and that it was, you know, but I think he had too much baggage in town at that point, and the decision for him to be someplace else was probably the right one for the service and for the park politically. With Bruce Noble's installation, it was a first superintendency for him. I found him to be an extremely difficult person to work for, as did many others. We had under regional direction undertaken a management review. The resources employees that were working for me were in agreement with the management review that it was time for a separate resources management division. They wanted to see a resource management division chief. because of the way that the agency was evolving and the way that money was being distributed, mm-hmm. They felt, and probably I think justifiably so, that I couldn't give full time and attention to these disparate functions.
So at that point, you were still in charge of the Rangers, the natural resources, the cultural resources, and no longer interpretation.
Correct.
Okay.
And in fact, part of the environment that we arrived in was a dismissal, the firing had just taken place, had just been completed on the natural resource specialist, a guy named Damian Sedney. Clay, after a protracted effort, was finally able to effect a discharge. The staff was traumatized on account of the way that Damian interacted with everybody there. Not having seen it personally, I couldn't go into any of the details, but I will tell you that the aftermath was that they were still tiptoeing around his old office. Nobody would touch anything in his office for fear that he would show up and it would result in some cataclysmic, mm-hmm. you know, confrontation. And so I backfilled that position with Elaine Furbish. Elaine, just as a side note, when I wanted to make the offer, again, the deputy regional director was kind of still at his finger in what's going on in the park here. He said, "What makes you think that someone of Elaine's caliber is going to want to work at Klondike?" I still can't believe that he actually said that.
I don't remember what he said.
Yeah, I was stunned. I was like, are you telling me that I shouldn't hire her because she's too good for us? All I could say in response was, you know, just think of how much she'll accomplish in whatever amount of time that she spends here. Is if she wants to come and work here, we would love to have her. I think she'd be dynamite.
From the regional perspective, Klondike was kind of the black sheep.
Yeah, well, as far as natural resources were concerned, because 90% of the focus, maybe more, 95-98% of the focus of the parks, funding, staffing, all of the planning work had all been focused on the history and the historical resources, archaeological resources, and short shrift given to the natural resources. It may be understandable, but it was certainly time. And thankfully, Elaine did turn out to be dynamite. She and I struck sparks probably initially because she felt like she had her feet under her and she just wanted to be given the free rein to take it. And I think once I gained more trust in the fact that that was indeed the case, we got along much better because I just basically turned her loose and she was de facto became the natural resource division chief,
she was the natural resources department.
At that point.
Except for maybe a few seasons.
And she started successfully competing for funding and really getting in there and starting to swing away at it, which is great.
And then was Carl, by this point, historian, or he was archaeologist, or what was the cultural
He was still archaeologist.
Okay.
And Doreen Cooper was on staff. Nobody told me that she actually worked for me until I think it was maybe the second week. Somebody said, "Oh, Doreen's office is over upstairs in Mascot," and I said, "What do you mean upstairs in Mascot?" And nobody did. I mean, Clay was kind of like, "There it is." So I would pulling on threads. I started to figure out who worked here, and where did they work? It's like trying to find people. Yeah, it was very interesting. Carl, again, chafed, I think, at having anybody question what he was up to, what he was doing. And it was much easier for us later when he was not working for me than it was when he was working for me, because my expectations were that he would actually produce more. And he saw himself, I think, as a resource for the park. And maybe more as, you know, wanting to be a program manager and not so much, you know, a professional, a researcher or a writer.
Well, and I'm wondering if you face difficulties of being, you know, coming from a ranger background to then be supervising a historian or an archaeologist or a natural resource. Did you feel you weren't qualified to supervise them in that way?
My degree was in a natural resource field and a lot of natural resource programs. My experience in planning involved a lot of resource work. And at Petroglyph, I supervised the archaeologist and a cultural specialist there. There was we undertook a petroglyph monitoring or an inventory program. There was very little in the way of anything like archaeology in terms of digging, but it was so I'd had experience in supervising resources in the past. Channel Islands similarly had a lot of experience with resources, researchers, institutions. It's not unfamiliar ground for me.
But that doesn't mean that the people being supervised might not have felt that you were not experienced in their particular field.
Yes, and absolutely. You know, that if they saw me coming in as a ranger, and they recognized that the evolution of the funding mechanisms and the agency, the way it was being driven, they wanted to have a division, their own division chief, there at the table to compete for monies. And I could see the need for that as well. I was spread too thinly by virtue of everything that had been loaded into the position that I had. You know, it's everything from collateral duty safety officer for the park to the leasing program, which is, and for me, was the biggest part of the job the entire time I worked at the park there.
Well, we'll get to the leasing.
Right.
I have a question on the management review you talked about. That happened before you got there, or that was, you were already there?
Yeah. The management review came as, after Clay left.
Okay.
And I think there were a lot of questions raised, and probably as many by the resources folks as anybody else, but a lot of questions raised in administration, because there was no chief of administration in the park. There was an admin tech.
So it was all sort of a lot of top-heavy, the superintendent and nobody else sort of under them.
Well, there was a superintendent and an admin tech and the chief ranger, and then you're starting to see the evolution of the need for more specialization. And it all almost needed to happen all at once. And so not too terribly long after I arrived, I think Clay had decided to advertise a chief of administration position and hired Betty Rickliffs into that position. And Betty arrived, what's the best way to characterize that? She arrived wearing her spurs.
And her red power suits.
And a red power suit. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, Betty arrived, wanting this to be a springboard to a superintendency, and she was going to make that happen.
She was ready to take charge.
She was ready to take charge. Yep, and she was loud and as often as not wanted to stand. I used to joke with people and say, she'd stand on the conference room table if you'd let her. You know, she was going to be there and in charge.
Well, also if it was the first person in that chief of admin position, she may have felt like she was there to get the place in shape.
Sure. And to some degree, that's absolutely what the park needed. It had some issues with prior staff kind of it becoming moribund. I don't know how else to describe it, and I won't, in this case, name names, but what I will say is that, things needed to be shaken up.
So by moribund, you mean people who were in positions
who had been there too long and kind of settled into their little nest, and, you know, there was nothing new going to happen on their account. In fact, they were just going to resist all change. You know,
they weren't being productive, and there was no accountability for...
Yeah, there was little accountability for their time, you know. So, yes, Betty had her work cut out for her. With the management review came the decision to spin off resources to its own division. Mm-hmm. That meant another new division chief opening. Now remember, we've gone from superintendent and chief ranger to superintendent and chief ranger and chief of interp soon after my arrival. And then now adding chief of admin.
Right.
And now adding chief of resources. And you also, I've neglected to mention along here at maintenance. And so there was a chief of maintenance.
That was also in this management review.
He was there during this management review. That's John Warder.
But was that, he was already a chief of maintenance? It already was its own separate thing, or?
I don't know if he actually had that title at that time. So it might have been as a result of the, you know, the decision to set up, okay, co-equal divisions. Yeah. So we end up with John Warder, who had been working very effectively at executing the rehab program on the buildings, because he had money, he had funding streams with each one of these projects.
Right.
But they were kind of reaching the end of that. He was when I arrived there, he was still working on Pantheon and Red Front. The joke was there that the Pantheon was on stilts. It was the historic fabric of the building was basically suspended above, and they were building a new building underneath it.
Wow.
The Red Front was entirely new fabric.
Which is the Red Front?
If you're looking at where the today, you would see a sign that would say, let's see.
Because that's not.
There's the Junior Ranger Activity Center, the JRAC they call it, that is catty corner from the hardware store.
It looks like one building, but it's actually referred to as two buildings.
Okay. So the mascot? No.
No. Up the street, another block from the mascot. On the other side, the opposite side of the street from the mascot.
Okay.
There's an open lot. If you can picture that, there's a little garden area there.
Uh-huh.
Okay. The building that's immediately north of that garden area is red.
Oh, okay.
And that is the Red Front building that's now leased out to a jeweler, I think. And so you'll see it'll say something like Gold Rush Jewelry or something like that.
I just haven't heard the word Red Front before.
So the Red Front was ordinarily, by policy, the National Park Service does not build fake historic buildings, and yet we did this. You know, again, that was initiated before my time there, so that project was in progress when we arrived, because the historic fabric of the next building, the very next building, the Pantheon Saloon, was essentially a shed roof that would have looked idiotic without a building, it being attached to another building next to it. And so the justification was made that, well, we need to rebuild the Red Front because there's nothing salvageable there.
Right.
And we can salvage
the Pantheon,
the upper part of the Pantheon. And so the lower part of the Pantheon is all going to be new fabric as well. So there's new foundation, new construction through most of it. The only way you see the historic fabric is actually to go up the back stairs, the Pantheon.
Mm-hmm.
And at the top of the stairs, there's a little tiny door about this high, okay? And if you open that up, You can get into, there's a light switch in there, turn that on, and you'll see all of the structure, the historic structure, next time you're there. Ask to have the nickel tour of the upstairs of the Pantheon. So that was in construction, but as far as John Warder was concerned, that's the end of the rehab program. That's the, you know, that's, we're done. So the world was changing for maintenance as well. John was not interested in going to the MAG, the Maintenance Advisory Group, in Anchorage to sit at the table, the round table, with the rest of the maintenance chiefs and fight over whatever funding might become available. He'd always had his own funding streams, never had to work for it. And so he really focused on being the foreman for that crew. And so when he retired, when he was ready to leave, the next individual in, the expectation is they would be a maintenance manager, a program manager. Mm-hmm. And as it turned out, the individual that they hired wasn't really up to the job either. We had to wait for Johnny Powell to show up to really have somebody take the bull by the horns. And Johnny worked at Denali for many years, knew all these folks in region, knew the other program managers, and was incredibly successful at what he did in being both a foreman but also a program manager. That helped. In administration, when Betty moved on, I had it's fair to say, an ongoing conflict with Betty. It was a power struggle. It was very challenging for me. So when she left, the individual that was hired to replace her, I'm trying to think if I'm going to get this in the wrong order, but eventually the individual was hired in, as it turned out, she arrived thinking that it was time for her to clean house as well. And so the longtime employees in the park there saw someone come in who just made it almost all but impossible for the administrative staff that were there to continue working. The superintendent at the time was so shocked by the performance of what he saw there. He couldn't understand how he'd made all these background calls, no clue that this was going to be an issue. This person was such a terror that the regional office staff actually went to work to try and find out what the story was, and eventually discovered that there had been plenty of other clues. It's just that she had buried them, and she'd gotten the assistance of others in burying her background as well. And so she'd falsified her application, she was terminated based on the falsified application. And that coincided with my latest crisis with the medical, and that's what led to the opening, the opportunity, if you will, I saw.
Of you to become the chief of admin.
Of me to become the chief of admin and to end this continuing issue with my own background and the job.
And so becoming chief of admin, it solved that commissioned officer health.
Basically, that gets handed off to Tim. Mm-hmm. You say, Tim becomes chief ranger. My job, as I alluded to already, we haven't talked about much, the leasing program was such a large component of the work that I did, and the management review that had been undertaken. Mm-hmm. Years earlier, had already said when the opportunity arose, the feeling was that the management of the leasing program should be vested in administration and no longer with the chief ranger. And so my pitch to them was to Jim Corliss, the superintendent at that time, my pitch was, Jim, you can implement a major component of this management review. I'll take the portfolio of leasing with me. I know enough about administration in other respects. You know, I'll learn what I need to learn, but I'll be able to mend the wounds that were inflicted by this woman, the individual whom we fired in as chief of administration. She almost drove folks to resign.
Right.
And so I said, I can mend that. I can work with those individuals. I can carry on the job of chief of admin, but more importantly, I can carry on the job of the leasing program. And this will implement and it'll end the issue of my medical problems with the way that the service had gone. After extensive consultation of the regional office, I think they all saw the value in this and thankfully signed off on it. Said, yes, that's what we want to see happen. It wasn't, you know, without some pains in the process. For me, it meant that they wanted to keep the position of chief of admin at an 11. So it was essentially an involuntary downgrade was the way it was handled. Mm-hmm. So there was grade protection for 2 years. And Tim, I think, eventually ended up with a promotion out of the deal. So, but that took some time.
And now at this point, the new division chief for resources, that had already all been implemented?
Teresa Thibault was selected as chief of resources, and she and Elaine came into immediate conflict. I think Elaine, to her credit, tried her best to make it all work. Teresa was, in my view, out to establish that she would truck no one else being in charge of anything, independent in any way. And essentially forced Elaine to make a decision as to whether she would stay or not. And instead of trying to transfer out, Elaine decided to resign. And I would say, probably to her credit, she recognized that, you know, it just this. She enjoyed doing what she can do, and she was fully capable of continuing to do good work as a contractor outside the service. Mm-hmm. And I think people through the years have tapped her on any number of occasions for various programs on that account. Mm-hmm. So again, my hat's off to Elaine, but again, Teresa saw this as a springboard to her move to a superintendency, was the same. So we had a three-way power struggle going on, Teresa, Betty, and I, for some time. It was just painful. With Bruce Noble at the helm, it was doubly painful. Bruce at one point brought in an individual as an intervention, if you want to call it that. Mm-hmm. The region had sent down
like a mediator?
EO, yeah, like a mediator initially to interview park staff. At the end of that, they said, oh my God, this is a stab. the staff, they're all about to stab one another. It had reached crisis proportion, so mm-hmm. they actually hired someone to come in to conduct a team building session. I'll call it the intervention, but the team building session was a retreat. And we met at the Chilkoot Trail Outpost. So we were not in the park offices. Mm-hmm. We all went out to the Chilkoot Trail Outpost.
What was it that Bruce Noble said out there? Remember that famous quote? Mm-hmm. What was it he said? I forgot now.
So we have an outside contractor who's basically there to be the mediator. And this is the team building session. We're all going to, you know, hold hands and, you know,
sing Kumbaya.
Yeah, well, you know, exercises of one sort or another. Bruce decides he wants to say a few words before we get started. And literally, all the chairs are arranged in a big circle. Because, of course, this is the team building. That's right. And Bruce said, things have been said, bad things about himself, Bruce Noble. People have been talking behind his back. And he just wanted everyone here to know there will be retribution.
Those were his words.
Wow.
There will be retribution, he said declaratively.
At the beginning of the
and the moderator here looked
he
like he'd been turned
Kumbaya.
To stone. He looked like he'd been turned to stone. Like you could see him going,
what?
What? That wasn't in the script.
Right. Yeah. And we're supposed to start how?
Yeah, yeah. How do we contain? He just, you could see him take this long, deep breath and think,
he should have
just going to pretend like I didn't hear that, and we're just going to carry on.
They should have just disbanded right then and there and said, okay, we're done. There was no point in doing anything more.
I was
going to say what came out of the
For most retreat. People, it was a frightening period to have Bruce there because he just didn't seem to get it. He took me soon after arriving, and I was still trying to show him kind of how the trail center worked, talked about the, you know, the backcountry operations. He didn't seem to get that at all. He'd come from Harper's Ferry. And one day I was doing just that, just the two of us alone in the trail center. He said, suddenly, like, almost cut me off and blurted out, if you'll make me look good, I'll make you look good. Like, deal? Sure. I'm thinking, what did you just say there? What are you afraid you're not going to look good? And so, are you afraid I'm going to sabotage you? I'm not here to do that. I don't know where that's coming from. And that's what I had almost had to tell him, was I just don't get this.
So I was working for ANHA at that time.
Okay, the Alaska Natural History Association.
Yeah, and so I wasn't actually working for anyone at the park. I was working for someone in Anchorage. And Steve Heitz, along with Jeff Brady and Deadman's a little bit, you know, they decided that they were going to make a complaint that the Park Service had a bookstore which was in competition with their bookstores, okay? But it was really Steve Heitz that decided that this was a way to kind of poke the Park Service or whatever. And he started out by saying, well, you know, the books that you're selling are in direct competition with my books. So any Jack London books, any Robert Service books, I'm selling those, so you can't sell those. So he goes to Bruce Noble and he says, well, we can't, you know, be having, you know, competition here, you know. So Bruce Noble says to me, bring books up here to my office. So I do. And he goes, okay, well, you can't sell any Jack London books, you can't sell any Robert Service books. And I was like, well, what's left? There's not much left, you know. And at that time, ANHA wasn't selling, you know, little T-shirts and cups and everything. Nothing like that. It was just books. Okay, so when you cut out half of the books that, and most of the ones that made any money, I mean, I was able to double the income of ANHA. It was making $40,000 a year gross when I started. It made $80,000 when I left.
Wow.
So I had, you know, titrated which books, where to put them and everything. You know, I was doing really good. Well, anyway, along in there, Tina Sear, you probably already have met her. Her father, Paul Sear, worked for White Pasture many years.
Right.
And then when the railroad reopened, they hired her as doing marketing.
And Alice Sear, her mother, did a lot of interpretation.
Uh-huh. Exactly.
Right.
So Tina saw that she was working with Reed on the 100-year...
Centennial.
So she knew him, and she got to know me a little bit. And she realized I was working for Anaheim, making like $10 an hour. And she said, well, how would you like to work with White Pass for me? And so she plucked me away from Anaheim to work over at White Pass, which was, you know, I made more money, had my own computer, was doing different things. It was a lot of fun. But what I found out was that Bruce Noble wrote a letter, which I saw, to Steve Heitz, saying that the problem was gone, that I was gone.
Right.
And so therefore, there was no longer a problem with Ann Hutt. And I saw that letter and I thought, what a bastard to stab me in the back because I moved on because he had already decided that Region wanted to make this all nice, you know, so you're not going to... So that was my opinion of Bruce Noble.
Your experience with him, yes.
Yeah. Steve Heitz, I didn't have as much of a problem with. I could understand what he was, where he was going. It was like, you know, he's making a push.
It's a private business. And...
Yeah, and I mean, I never had a problem with Steve Heitz or Gayla or Monica. I was friends with the Carlsons, but gosh, I sometimes go up there to her office, you know, to see her various things. I always thought that was funny.
So that retreat where Bruce said that, I mean, did anything productive come out of that retreat for the staff and people getting along with each other?
Well, I think the exercises that had been planned by the moderator, you know, were certainly beneficial. He was on the right track.
Right. Well, I guess did things change in the office after that?
No, I wouldn't say... I think it went from being super critical to simmering. You know, I think for most people it was a very difficult time. I can recall Bruce deciding at one point that the staff meetings we were having, weekly division chiefs or squad meeting, that he thought those were running too long. And his solution to that was to bring in an egg timer. And he would give each division chief like 3 minutes or 5 minutes on the egg timer. And you'd be sitting either in his office or in the conference room. And in mid-sentence, it would go ding. And I just stopped talking. It's like, this is so incredibly insulting. You know, that was just an example of, he was like, he didn't quite know how to relate to people. At one point, he berated us all because no one really wanted to travel to training or conferences and so on, because traveling in and out of Skagway in winter, which is the only time you really could travel, you couldn't travel in the summer, so you were really limited to off-season. That's when you had to take all your leave and attend any... working groups that you'd be involved in. And so I almost invariably travel to Anchorage at least twice a year. And other training would take you out. Well, people would say, you know, I mean, it's almost invariably a week of transit and then a week of either training or conference or whatever. And so it would, if you had a family, especially, it was a problem. And most of us were not interested in spending too much time. Well, he stood up at one point and just berated us all because he said, you know, this is a privilege. I love traveling. And we knew that because he was mostly gone when he could, whenever he could, he would be gone and he would leave everyone else holding the. So I mean, just kind of felt like none of us, we were not connecting with him, and his expectations sometimes were almost impossible to meet. He wanted to have, let's see, what was the event? I'm trying to remember. I remember it was outside. And everybody, all the chairs set up out there, was, you know, the podium.
Was it for the centennial?
It was later than that.
It was the parks. It was the 25th anniversary of the park.
Oh, okay.
Of the creation of the park. Thankfully, that went off reasonably well. He had me order these. We actually had produced a medallion that was basically a stamped coin, if you mm-hmm. will, about the size of a silver dollar. And he was able to hand those to everybody. All the invited guests got one. You know, was very careful about, you know, this is a, he was wanting to communicate. This is a big privilege for everybody. I don't know. It was an awkward period of time. I was much happier working for Jim Corliss later, I'm going to draw a blank on her name. Went to Glacier Bay. Let's see.
Oh.
We'll come to you later.
Yeah, so it sounds like that work environment, people were not getting along, and
there was a lot of competition, interdivisional competition, power struggles, and I think that if it had been managed differently, maybe not so much the case.
Mm-hmm. So how was staff morale?
I think most of the rest of the staff, as you'd expect, would kind of keep their heads down, you know, steer clear of it all if they could. I don't think they were at all happy with us as, mm-hmm. At times as division chiefs. They felt like, gee, we should make nice and all, you know, I mean, that was part of our job, and it should have been. It certainly was the case later. Different circumstances, different leadership, you know, and a different mix of individuals. It got better. That was probably the low ebb for me. It was very, very difficult. Part of medical issues that I faced was through this period, escalating blood pressure, which I find at the
a little stress.
And at some point, up at the clinic. You know, the clinic staff, of course, very small. I made some comment about, you know, the blood pressure, and a question was put to me, well, you know, there's a lot of stress at work. I said, yes. And in so many words, the feedback from the provider was, well, you and all the rest of them. In so many words, she was very cautious not to name any names, but it was so many words, it was like, well, you got company.
Yeah.
Yours isn't the only blood pressure that's, you know, peaking.
So what ended up being the thing that resolved it?
Staff changes. I mean, leadership change.
People left.
Yeah. I mean, you have Bruce moved on, and I believe it was a directed reassignment, just as it had been for Clay. You know, he was told, you're going to love, I'm trying to think, was it
Texas?
Missouri? No, it was Missouri. No.
I thought it was LBJ or something like that.
No, it was like a state office for like two or three parks under it. It was like Midwest region.
I can't remember.
And he was basically told, yeah, this is going to be a great job. You're going to love it.
I wonder how much regional must have known about this.
Yeah.
Power structure situation. Mm-hmm. Did they?
Which is why we were provided the team building.
Yeah, I was wondering how else they
crew
tried to assist. Or did they?
They started receiving, threats of grievances.
Yeah,
from the park staff, and I mean that's what brings it to the regional office mm-hmm. level. They find it increasingly difficult to ignore those.
Then there was some employees like Deb Etcher and Deb Sanders and Carl, mm-hmm. all they did was just this, you know.
Put their heads down.
Yeah, put their heads down and just start, and that's what they did. They hid out in their offices.
Yeah.
And you never saw them. Or if they came in, they were in tears. And yeah. and I saw that more than once. It was yeah. it was like very some of these people, you know, they're like you and me, you know, they're kind of introverts, they're kind of like people that, you know, we write, they're not good at, you know, dealing with these types of big A personalities that you know are come in and, you know, and so there was a real difference between some of the people that worked there that had been there for years, mm-hmm. and then some of the other ones that had come in there really kind of as a temporary training position before they get to their next big job.
Right.
You know, because that's the way Klondike was treated. It was a training park.
For a while, I mean, we must have had 5 or 6 new superintendents in a row.
Mm-hmm.
2 or 3 of those were permanent, and the balance were interim.
Or acting, you know, yeah.
This would be your acting superintendent for the summer. Show her how it all works. And that happened multiple times.
Right.
Sometimes one after the next. You know, we wouldn't have a permanent superintendent. We'd have a temporary and another temporary, and I think even a third one time.
And then when you were chief of admin, were you training those superintendents?
I'd say that or throughout my tenure there, we were training from Bruce on. We trained virtually everybody.
And how did you feel about that being part of your job?
I think the second or third time I was not selected as superintendent, and I wasn't the only division chief to apply, but I think each of us drew the same conclusion. This is never happening for me, you know, either through a combination of my own failings, and there certainly are those, and the history of what's gone on here and the baggage at this park and the fact that I wasn't ready to, you know, move someplace else, you know, to a more, an even remote, more remote circumstance, I recognize, okay, this is not happening. And so I will finish out my career here. I'll finish it out as chief of admin. And at that point, I think was a watershed moment for me, and I think you'd probably voice that as well, that it began to improve for me at home and at work.
Mm-hmm.
But it took accepting this and not chafing at this constantly, you know, recognizing that, okay, you know, my job is to do the best I can for the people who are working for me and for the resource, try and stay on top of the job. It's not an easy job. It was not even remotely easy. A big part of, I think for most people, what they didn't understand how much what was happening in the IT realm, how that role and responsibility was building an admin. And so Rose Parado, had worked for Betty. Betty had hired her, hired Rose as the IT specialist, and then they've been able to upgrade that position. But trying to keep that position filled was always difficult, and so as chief of admin, I found it difficult to fill that position as well. And in between incumbents, it would fall almost entirely to me to serve as IT specialist. And the regional office staff would handle what I couldn't, and then would tutor me in what I needed to do on site that they couldn't.
Running around to all the computers in the park, trying to upgrade them and turn them off and do this.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
A big part of what we tried to accomplish was to keep pace with the demands of the park, the employee, you know, just the programs that needed more and more support, the increasing number of servers and racks, and the wiring and air conditioning requirements for those. We had to at one point entirely replace all of the cabling, data cabling. We also set as a goal for ourselves to create an off-site backup for all of the data mm-hmm. for the park. And we're successful at doing that, of setting aside space in a new maintenance building, so it was off-site. Right. And I think we accomplished a tremendous amount in IT, but it was definitely not easy.
Well, to say, IT specialist is very specific training, and you were not coming from that background, and all of a sudden you become the IT person.
Right. And so I was capable enough of adapting to what needed to be done that I could plug those openings. I mean, at one point I had hired an individual as IT specialist. He came in with experience, I think, from, I want to say, Coast Guard. It wasn't terribly uncommon to hire somebody into the park, have them stay a week, a month, 2 months, and then throw up their hands because they just had never lived in a small town
right.
in remote circumstance, and they just, I mean, we had that happen more. I think he chafed at one point when I took issue with him having, he discovered in the course of his duties a bug in a Microsoft, some Microsoft software, an important one, he thought. And in telling me about this, he said that he had gone direct with Microsoft and then been threatened by Microsoft if he revealed this to anybody else, and then he counter-threatened them. And he was reassuring me that he'd already consulted with his attorney and he knew he was on firm ground. And I looked at him like, well, you know, you're actually a government employee.
Right.
And so your attorney isn't really, you can't do that. You know, this is among the things that, you know, you're going to have to adjust. You can't be doing this kind of thing of calling private companies and then basically threatening them back, you know, with countersuits or whatever. You know, these are your official duties. And he didn't last. He left.
You were like pulling wire between.
We were.
Attic.
Yeah.
Yeah, and installing. Yeah, I was installing new servers and. So yes, that was a big challenge.
Both for that reorganization where they, you know, got a new resources division and chief mm-hmm. and all that, and the IT thing makes me think some of that is the nature of the changing park, that mm-hmm. it was a small park, it got bigger, mm-hmm. they got more employees, it gets yeah. more complicated, now you need divisions that you didn't have before, technology is changing, mm-hmm. now we need computers and backups and all these things.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Evolutionary process in response to national priorities, national organizational changes, stovepiping of funding streams mm-hmm. Into these various disciplines. And, a lot of this is unavoidable. It would not have been desirable nor workable to attempt to sustain the original organization of the park. It needed to adapt. It
right.
needed to change. And that's why when the management review took place and when I sat down with the resource staff saying, this is what I'm hearing from the outside evaluators, from outside the park. How do you feel about this? Which direction do you want to go on this? How do you feel? And they all of them pretty much. I mean, with Carl and Elaine and Debbie, I think that was probably the primary players there, said yes, they thought it was time for a separate resources division. And I said, well, that's where we need to go. I mean, it's like, it's not for me to attempt to fight that. I could see the writing on the wall as well. So, yeah, it needed to happen.
But then there was the problem with the person who became the chief of resources.
The individual came in, I think, made life very difficult for all of her reports, direct reports. And so if you were to talk with Carl, talk with Elaine, talk with Debbie, you would hear, I guarantee you, you'd hear just that. Life was more difficult.
Now, how do you think they felt working under you? Did you ever get a sense?
I think there were varying levels, varying degrees of frustration or satisfaction. I think Carl was probably very frustrated.
With you?
With me, because my expectations of him were different than he had. And I would say that I've alluded to the fact that Elaine and I had issues because if I attempted to more closely direct or supervise her, she pushed back. Right. And she pushed back hard. And that only resolved when I acknowledged and recognized that she needed to be given that latitude to manage her program. Mm-hmm. She really needed that latitude. And as long as you kept your hands off and said, go forth and do good work. she did.
Yeah. Now, when you guys, there was all that fighting, the power struggle you mentioned. Do you have any examples of things you remember that you were fighting about?
In my recollection, most of the issues that I struggled with were the desire to make changes to infrastructure in the park that I felt were necessary based on my experience and judgment, and Teresa attempted to wrest control of virtually anything taking place in the park that she could link in any small way to the Triple X program, you know, the requirements for
compliance
work. And so the compliance was the iron glove, if you will. It latched on to virtually everything. And then if the pocket veto was absolutely a piece of cake for her. She just pocketed anything that wasn't going to be under her control. No, we haven't finished that. No, you got to finish compliance on that. An example, a concrete example, I felt was a very minor issue as far as compliance work would go, was the recognition that for years the park had partnered up with City of Skagway to publish a trails map. And the trails map, when I arrived, actually showed routes for hiking that went through private properties in Dyea. If you hiked those, you were walking through somebody's property or on a driveway that maybe wasn't on their property, but it was still how they accessed their, it didn't go anywhere except to their property. So people would hike the driveway and then on through because they saw it on the maps.
Right.
So we had a lot of friction that was unnecessary with inholders in the area in Dyea. I said, A, we need to change the maps, which we eventually were able to do. But of course, we had to wait to the following year, the next printing. And B, I said, if this is just a driveway to either one or multiple homes back here, properties here, I want the maintenance crew to route up and make signs that say private residence. And we'll put them on a small stake. We'll basically post each one of these driveways. I had Carl accompany me out We had a pile of these. We're going to put them at each one of the driveways. You know, people like McDermott's. And halfway through doing this, with Carl there to observe, okay, if we're going to dig a post hole here, yeah, we're going to put in a signpost, Carl will stand by as the archaeologist and observe, okay. Radio traffic from headquarters, Teresa is ordering Carl to return because she hadn't been consulted, or she felt that there wasn't, you know, the XYZ paperwork that hadn't been completed, and it was to end immediately. And I thought, okay, we've talked about this in staff meeting. This is not a surprise. It's not a surprise attack. We're meeting the obligation of making sure that we're not digging up historical artifacts here.
And at that point, were you and she, you were chief ranger and she was chief of resources? So you, yes, were not above her. Mm-mm. Supervisory. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But she decided when she heard that this is what was going on, that it needed to stop. And she would just pocket it. That would be the end of that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking, okay, well, this doesn't actually help our relationship with our inholders, who are the people who could report issues if we had any. It just prolongs the misery here.
Right.
The signs are out there now. So if you drive around IE, you probably have seen little signs that say private residence on a driveway. They just go out into
them,
the trees.
I'm sure they're there.
They were very, they were not large. Mm-hmm. They were not obtrusive. But changing the maps, changing and adding the signs ended that friction with certain landowners there.
I remember working on you with this map because as mm-hmm. the city, or was it Anha? I can't remember. One of the, not that one, the other one, the, Well, we did this one, but I was thinking about the
you were thinking
trail
about this.
Map.
This was a big deal.
Yeah,
this
we
was a big deal for
that's
us.
The Choku Trail map. I have that. That's a great right. map. So
this was not easy.
Yeah, Reed and I were the ones that actually did this, as I recall.
Yes.
We put this thing together.
Us and Denver Hall.
And Denver Hall. Yeah.
Parks Canada.
Now, our names are not on here, but we did this. And we had to get everybody to, you know, come over here and minutely check every little thing.
You mean all the text? The text had to be reviewed by everybody.
Yeah.
And not just on our side.
But on the Canadian side.
On the Canadian side. And a French version had to be produced as well, a French language version.
So it used to say on here the city and Anha and had all these, the same with this one. But because I put this one together.
And that one, this one is that's the Skagway Trail map.
Right. And so somewhere along the line I said, well, why should the Park Service and the Forest Service and the city and when I was working for the
Convention and Visitor Bureau,
CVB, this was our little logo. I said, let's just simplify this. Because, it took up half of a page,
all those logos.
And they weren't any longer contributing anything other than a little bit of money.
Right.
Originally, the Park Service had paid for
this
half of the right. production run.
And again, it shows Dewey Lakes Trail and the AB Mountain Trail and all that kind
right.
of stuff.
And this is a multi edition later, but
right.
originally this is what, and
right.
we had taken off, you know, certain trails like the Lost Lake Trail because everybody got lost on it. And
well, there's Lost Lake, and that's
See,
where
there used to be a trail that went
used
there
to be out this way to cut through these private properties.
Right. So
so those were to me open and shut case of how do you, this is not the way to manage a park. You don't make enemies out of your neighbors. You do everything you can to actually live compatibly.
Yeah. Well, that leads to my question about the community park relationships and what that was like during your tenure.
As Marlene said earlier, it gradually changed through time. I think through the combined efforts of almost everybody on staff, and as obviously the composition of the staff began to change through time, positions came open, there was a greater emphasis on local hire. So we were using more local hire positions to try and open the door. Now, most of the local people could not at all understand why the window of opportunity to even apply for Park Service positions was so small. Yes. It's like you couldn't get through, get squeezed through that opening. And we'd say, well, yes, because everybody and their brother used to want to work for the Park Service. And so they created this little tiny window and you have to squeeze through that. Well, people go, they throw up their hands. This is ridiculous. So eventually, the Alaska local hire, we could say, we're going to be using that more and more and more, and open that window of opportunity for more locals to apply. I think that helped a lot. Obviously, the rehab crew had been entirely local hire, but that was also kind of their downfall because they were hired under term appointments. Again, you can renew those for up to 4 years. And I think they even got a special dispensation somehow and were able to renew some of those for even longer. But their second four-year term, that was the end of the line. So among John Warder's last duties was essentially to let the entire rehab crew go, the last of those, including people at the time. I think Roy Nelson was on the rehab crew and eventually was brought in as a, I think what his title was.
He eventually went to work for the city.
He did, yeah. Yes.
But, and then like Don Corwin, he worked on some of the rehab
Corwin
stuff.
Was someone that, yes, super talented guy, very highly skilled, and everybody knew it. What he chafed at, what he could not accept was a significant change in equipment and protocols for the painting crew. He was eventually, in order to advance, instead of being just the carpenter, he became the supervisor over the paint crew, the restoration crew, over the rehab crew. The painters were using scaffolding, extensive use of scaffolding, and the park, after a safety review, decided all this old scaffolding needs to be retired, and we bought all new Safeway scaffolding, top of the line stuff, spent a ton of money on it. And at some point, Don chafed at that because he was so accustomed to the old scaffolding, went back to using the old scaffolding, told the crew to do just that behind Lynch and Kennedy. And somebody came to my office at one point saying, you as safety officer need to see what Don has set up for the use of the crew. And he had a wheeled scaffold up on blocks.
Oh my God.
Behind, and it was then roped off in odd ways to sort of stabilize it. If it didn't roll off the blocks, then it would be okay. Mm-hmm. And the same thing up high, and it was, that was the end of the line.
Yeah,
he'd been warned, and it's like people are at risk here.
This is unacceptable.
Yeah, this is and at any rate. So yes, there were a lot of really talented people. As Marlene said, most of them just trying to keep their head down and do a good job, and you know.
But so, what are your feelings about building that relationship with the community? You just sort of said you thought that was important.
Among the things that I think people were doing was getting more and more involved in either city committees, in special programs of one sort or another. I got invited early on to join the board of directors for the Chamber of Commerce. And I remember Clay hollering down the hallway that first summer saying, they have an opening on the board of directors of the chamber. Do you want to be a chamber board member? And I looked at him and I said, They know I work for the government, right? It's like they're not under some misapprehension that. And Clay was essentially telling me, you could do this as part of your job. This is be part of the community outreach. And so I got then to meet a whole array of other people I never would have met otherwise. Tina Sear was certainly among them, the local bank manager, it was a bunch of people. Great folks. And I also got sucked into working on all the activities that other folks who never had a weekend in the summer months I got involved in. So fundraising for the chamber, organizing meetings. Eventually I served as president of the chamber, the direction at the national level regarding the Chamber of Commerce in particular, because as the national chamber became more politicized, the direction came out from WASO that make sure that you can't do this on government time. This is not, you can't be an officer of any of these. And the same actually was determined to be the case for people like Deb Sanders, who'd been on the, what was the title they used for that? They had the city had a number of advisory committees essentially. In the case of the city museum had a citizens advisory committee as well. So she sat on
historic
that.
Historic district commission, wasn't it?
And the HDC, Carl was a member of the historic district commission for the city. That's the way everybody wanted it. They wanted a park service representative on these and to speak to the particular issues. Well, we were all essentially told, you can't do that anymore as an official Park Service representative. You have to essentially resign. Right. And so by that time, I think the groundswell was already there for better relationships. It wasn't as critical, but for a time, I think those were crucial. My involvement in the chamber, the volunteer fire department, I was... it was a little dicey, again, because of which hat are you wearing when. But for 6 years, I've served as an engineer on the volunteer fire department. So I had a Park Service radio. I'm trying to think how these are. I'm normally, if there were a call paged out, I would have gotten it on the Park Service radio anyway. But I have a city pager, I think, at one point. Clay Alderson did the same thing. He used to serve as a dispatcher for the fire department. I can recall him running from his office. He'd get a page, and he would run down the hallway, and he was headed over to the fire hall, where he would take up the duties of the dispatcher, since they did not have a dispatcher, on a call. So if there were a fire call, what I told everybody at the fire department was, if the call is for a Park Service building, I will go direct to the scene as an NPS employee, as the chief ranger, with fire as part of my responsibilities. If it's any other building, I can respond as a volunteer for the fire department. And what I would do is make sure if I was in uniform, I would take off my uniform shirt, so I'd have a white t-shirt on, and then turnouts, fire gear.
Right.
And others in the park followed suit. So we had, there were people involved, more and more involved, contributing on a regular basis to various, what are viewed as beneficial organizations in one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
I think that had a big impact. Hiring more locals had a big impact. Addressing some of the festering, long-standing issues. Fifth and Spring got ironed to some degree. It's resurfaced
apparently
again,
yes,
more recently. Yeah, I found myself thinking, not again. Yeah.
Well, and as you say, the land issues out in Dyea.
Land out in Dyea, I was made, it was made clear to me that while the Park Service had, at one time, had the responsibility for management of Dyea Flats, and the lands surrounding the NPS ownerships under an agreement, a cooperative agreement with the state of Alaska, had had management responsibility for those lands. They'd blown it because of the issue with the radio-controlled modelers.
Mm-hmm, the airplanes.
The RC modelers, yeah, the airplanes. And they wanted to use the flats once a year. You know, they park all their vehicles out there, apparently. I never saw it because it was all done and said, you know, said and done for, whatever, by the time I arrived. But people still, they pinched me over it more than once. They were still sore.
That they had been... told they couldn't do that anymore.
They had been told, and the way they had been told, my predecessor, Bruce Reed, apparently had been pretty heavy-handed about it. I couldn't tell you. I mean, I've had people tell me that he blazed up, you know, to these people and sprayed them with gravel with the truck, you know, and told them, you know, whatever. And other people have said, no, that didn't happen. You know, so it got blown up,
right.
But it was all about control, local control, local influence involvement, and for a time, I think a lot of folks felt that Dai was their playground. They would go out and shoot clay pigeons. They would go out and dirt bikes and ORVs and horses and you know what anything went out there. At one point, cutting trees and. The expectation was that, gee, if that could continue, that would be fantastic. Well, times change, people change, the culture of the community changed, and today, if you drive out to the flats, what you find is something that looks an awful lot like a park.
So when you started, all those uses you just mentioned had already been stopped?
No. Those were uses that were still taking place south of that dividing line between National Park Service ownership and proprietary control, and immediately south of the town site,
mm-hmm.
Lands that had originally been State of Alaska lands, and then, as a consequence of the blow up of the Park Service, the city included in their municipal entitlement selections made to the state of Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And so while it took some years for the title to those lands to be vested with the city, they were given management control under an MOU
mm-hmm.
between the city and the state, where they said, why, yes, we'll promise not to disturb or deface or destroy archaeological cultural resources, and we'll take care of it. You know, it'll all be good. And for a while, people are in roughshod over it. But that's all gone at this point.
But when you were, did you implement any land use policy things out in Dai under your tenure?
Not on affecting those lands directly, because those lands were already out of our control.
Right.
On the NPS-owned lands, there were certainly pushes for certain distinct uses that people really thought should happen. And I'm primarily thinking about the horse tour operations.
Mm.
Commercial use authorizations were under my purview. In addition to the leasing. So CUAs were issued for, and I believe still are, for hiking on the Chilkoot Trail, including guided backpacking, but also day hikes, commercial day guided day hikes, rafting on the Tyre River,
mm-hmm.
although that's probably changed just this year. And then anything like guided van tours, bicycle tours, horse tours, walking tours, anything like commercial operations.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Robert Murphy, who is now quite the tycoon in Skagway, he owns more acreage in Dyea than anyone else. It's mostly up on the hillside, but not entirely. Zip line tours, wheeled dog sled tours, some kind of food and bed and food and alcohol operations out there now. I mean, you know, it's really boomed.
Now, those are in Park Service lands that he does? No. Mm-hmm.
No. So but he has to drive through Park Service lands to get there. We can't regulate that because it's essentially a public highway.
Right.
So that's the only access he has to his lands. And so I'd say many dozens of times a day, van loads of his paying passengers are on back and forth through the park. However, he also owns, like, it's either 5 or 10 acres of land further on the flats, if on the level terrain, but in the forest further north of the town site. And on that, he located a stables, and his vans take people out there, get on the horses, and they file on through the park and out to the flats, and then loop back, come back the same way. Murphy really wanted that tour to not be on a road, but instead be on its own trail and along the river. And that would have taken the horses through the town site more directly than they were. At that time, they were coming through the slough that's in the town site there. The slough used to be subject to tidal action, no longer. And I'm not sure about the salmon run, whether there's anything in there now. I kind of doubt it. But in any case, the horses, horse tours were on back and forth, as were cars driving back and forth through the slough there. Mm-hmm. And that was before the construction of the Cedar Bridge. With the Cedar Bridge construction, we forced the route for the horse tours to use the road exclusively from his property on down to the flats and back. And he tried for quite some time, a number of years, to get his own trail. And at one point, I think we even said, we will seriously consider that, but we want to see that your compliance with the permit provisions is that you can do this start to end for the season and take care of any damage that the horses create. And he didn't. So that was kind of the end of that. I mean, he's continued, and to this day, I think, in permitting, you know, the park permits the horse passage, but it's all on the road, the graded road.
Right.
One of the big accomplishments I always felt was ending the use of just flat out stinky, the world's stinkiest pit toilets in the campground in Dyea and at the trailhead, the Chilkoot trailhead, and eventually out at the town site. And so through specialized funding requests, we were able to get money to put in these vault toilets that
that vent.
They were advertised as SSTs, the sweet smelling toilets. They have a big convective column of black tube that you see on the back of them.
It's fairly standard at parks. Denali has them.
Yes. And you know, they're package deals, you know. You basically order them, they get delivered on a pallet, and we had our crews actually build them, put them together. They were not cheap. They're spendy, but made a big difference. On the Chilkoot Trail, we were having more and more problems trying to find places to dig pits. The routine had been to dig just a standard long drop toilet. and Sheep Camp, we essentially ran out of anywhere to dig a new one, you know, that hadn't already been used. And it was at that point I found, doing some research, I found somewhere along, I'm trying to think, it was New Hampshire, might have been, along the Adirondack Trail.
Mm-hmm. Appalachian Trail.
They're a group there had pioneered the use of what they were calling moldering privies. We knew it was going to be a very difficult deal to put in anything like a composting toilet. They require some kind of terrain, I mean, a pretty big facility and a lot of attention mm-hmm. and time, which we weren't going to have. But we eventually did, and I would give Tim all the credit for this, because, you know, once we put him, I put him onto it, and it's like he took it and ran and did just that. And I think that was the start of the use of what they were calling the moldering privies. And it was essentially, you know, an elevated platform on which the outhouse is built, a screened enclosure for the area below, and the addition of a lot of wood chips to what goes onto the mass mm-hmm. there. The liquids basically either drain away and or evaporate. And with the addition of the wood chips, eventually you can turn this mass and you can get slow composting.
You get organic matter of some sort.
Yeah, you have to add organic matter. Okay. You've got to, you know, but you end up with something that you can then safely basically bag up and fly out and use in intensive, like, basically eventually as fertilizer
yeah.
because it's composted, but it takes years. It's not fast compost, right. Not hot compost. So that made a big change in the operations along the trail and eventually in Dai, but that had been a long time coming. Those are just, I just thought that was a big improvement. The relationship with Parks Canada, you know, was always a big part of what I did in a lot of ways. So, I don't know, do you want to
take a break? Yeah. Sure, you've been doing a lot of talking. You want to take a rest for a second?
That'd be good.
Okay.